The Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab number 256 for Monday, April 26th,
2010. Ooh, fancy.
Greetings, folks, and welcome to the Mac Observer's Mac Geek Gab. I'm Dave Hamilton here in Durham, New Hampshire, and live on Ustream. On the other side of Ustream is
John F. Braun in Fairfield, Connecticut. Oh, just up for a little nap here.
That's right. So this is show number 256, which we decided was special enough to warrant a special occasion, because 256 is, of course, a very geeky number, John.
Well, it's 2 to the 8th, I believe. Now, some people argued that, you know, 255 is a magic number if you include zero, which I certainly agree.
But we didn't include zero. In fact, there never was a show zero.
Well, that's what I was going to say. Somebody wrote me and I said, well, we'd have to record a show zero in order to make this significant. So we're not going to record a show zero.
No, the time machine's
broken. We're going to record a show 256.
That's
right. This is it. So 2 to the 8th. For you people that count in base 2, and if you don't, then try it. It's cool.
That's right. And for everyone listening on the podcast feed, which is, of course, most of you, we are doing this. We are recording this while also broadcasting our video live over Ustream. But don't sweat it. We will do our best to ensure that that the audio is full of all the information that it needs to be. So one of the things that we talked about, you know, when we did our 100th show, John, we did a pretty cool thing. We talked about all the computers that that you and I had each used. And then, of course, you know, that kind of told the story of how we met, or at least bits and pieces of that story. And so, of course, we didn't want to rehash that, but it was so much fun. And and everybody seemed to enjoy it, including, I know, you and I. So the idea with this here is we figured, well, you know, the thing that is second most important, you know, if you make the computers the most important thing in our computing life, the thing that's second to that really is the way that we connected to other computers and each other and how that all worked. And so we figured we'd talk about that. And the more I started building my list, the more interesting I found it becoming. In fact, it was like a walk down memory lane, not unlike our initial computing thing. So that's what's on the agenda first. And then if we've got time, I just came back from a trip. So of course, there's always some travel escapades to discuss and then questions if there's time. I'm thinking, though, John, that I want to talk about our first sponsor before we dig in, because I have a feeling when we dig in, we're going to get lost, and that's okay. So I hope you folks have some time. Our first sponsor, and for our video folks out there, no, I didn't spend the time and build special animations or anything. It took me long enough to figure out how to use CamTwist this well. So you just get our mugs and maybe some cool transitions. But our first sponsor is a sponsor that's been with us for a while, CircusPonies.com with Notebook. Notebook is it's an electronic organizer, but it allows you to compartmentalize the data that you're organizing into, well, separate notebooks. When you start a new notebook, it can be sort of daunting, although it's a familiar interface, because you pull up a white-lined notebook, and you can start typing right into it. But where it really gets powerful is when you start bringing in things like PDFs and pictures. You can then annotate these things. If you get a fax, if say you use the eFax service or one of the various fax services that send you email, if you get a document in your fax, you can actually pull it into Circus Pony's Notebook, and it will OCR that, convert it into text, and allow you to copy and paste that text and also annotate it just like any other image. It comes with a bunch of templates, and this is probably the best place to start because it can be a little daunting. So check out one of their templates and use that to, even if you're not going to build your final notebooks with it, use it to get a feel for how the software works. Again, this is Notebook from Circus Ponies. It's available at CircusPonies.com. $49.95, but of course it comes as a free download, so you can download it and try it out for a month before you commit. My guess is if you're looking for something like this, you'll love it. But go ahead and try it out. And then $49.95, all available at circusponies.com. And with that, all right, John, I know you've been online longer than I have. So why don't you start and tell us about, before we even start with the electronic connectivity, you know, there was the old way of communicating with people, right? Where you'd actually bring your box of discs for your Apple II over to someone else's house and you'd spend a night, you know, playing each other's games and checking things out and yes, copying things and sharing and all mm-hmm. that stuff that makes people get all antsy these days. But that's how word got around about new software, right?
Well, I would say pretty much that's the case. And I think both Dave, when you and I grew up, the way to do that, no, it was not 3.5 inch. It was actually 5 1/4 inch floppy disks.
Right. That's right.
Sometimes it would be cheapskates and we'd actually punch a hole into the disk to use the back of it because back then, if I remember correctly, it was 140K, 5 1/4 inch floppies. No, we were not around during 8 inch. Well, we were. There were 8 inch floppies, but there were 5 1/4 inch floppies, 140K on the Apple II. And some of us who wanted to do double duty would punch a hole. They actually made these little devices that let you punch a hole so you could write to both the front and the back of your 140K discs. And that's what we did. And then I don't know if we should get into, Dave, the copy protection hell that we had to experience back then, which is pretty much any game. And you know, I was promising people, and I think we're going to, although everybody sees us, Dave, as, you know, just, you know, shining examples of obeying the law and all that. I must say that you and I both dabbled in the world of, I would say, technical
experimentation
challenges of maybe how shall I put it?
Maybe it's best not to put it.
No. Both you and I learned about ways to defeat copy protection on floppy disks, and we had some friends that were very into that. I think you and I both dabbled in that, but it was a constant battle, and it still aggravates, I think, a lot of us to this day that, you know, some companies would spend so much time trying to come up with clever ways of preventing you from backing up or enjoying your software.
So, yeah. Yeah.
So tangent so, there.
So, yeah. So you're right. We would trade discs back and forth and hang out. And there was a social thing. I mean, sometimes it would be more than just two people. You get a bunch of people together. But then came the days of, OK, now we want to connect our computers directly to each other. And you know, and experience that. And that really was kind of the beginning of the BBS age, right? I mean, there was no internet to speak of at that point. So I know you got into that world probably several years before. Do you know how old you were? I know how old you were when I got started. Do you know how old you were when you got started?
Well, I'm going to maybe delve into some, adventures that I had, but I would say around 16 was when I started. So my first computer was an Apple IIe, and the first modem that I had was the trusty, which I don't think the company's in business anymore, the Novation AppleCat.
Right.
So there were two types of modems you can get back then. There was either a modem that you put in a slot in your computer, which was, you know, either Apple II or IBM or whatever, or you could get one that connected to a serial port. And my choice was the AppleCat, not only because it fit into a slot in the Apple, and it just did so many things beyond just being a modem. And this will, again, delve into the dark side a bit here. But I got the Novation AppleCat modem, which when it started was a Bell 103 or 300 bit per second modem, which back then was, well, that's what you did over phone lines.
Right.
I don't think you ever got the AppleCat, Dave, though I know you dug the features of it.
Yeah, I did dig the features. So our first Apple computer was an Apple IIc, into which you couldn't really put an internal modem. I think there may have been one down the road, but in general, you couldn't. And it was actually an interesting machine to have a modem with. So let me find my notes here to make sure I'm not missing anything. But yeah, I had a buddy like everybody did. And John and I did not know each other at this point. But I had a buddy who was an IBM guy. And he was an older guy who was married. He had kids. I think he had kids. Maybe he didn't have kids. But, you know, he was certainly much older than I was at 14 or 13 or whatever. But he was a friend of my parents. And And he, you know, he was the one that showed me. I remember being at his house when he dialed up to another computer and was like, oh, dude, you know, you see the text scroll across the screen. And it's like, whoa, that's coming from somewhere else. So, I got hooked there and I said, all right, I got to get a modem. And so he had this it was a 1200 baud modem that he sold me. And because the Apple II, the modem had, it was an external modem. So it had an RS-232, a 25 pin serial port on it. And the Apple IIc had a Mini 9, a DIN 9, maybe it was called, port.
Right.
Yeah, so it had that port on it. But what I had to do was get a cable for it. So I went to, you know, the local computer store, got the DIN 9 to, modem cable, and I plugged it in. This modem had lights on it, and I'd try to type commands to the modem or do things, and I could see the lights, like, sort of flicker, but it never really worked right. And I couldn't get it to do anything. You know, it wouldn't dial, it wouldn't answer, but I could tell something was happening. But man, it was really frustrating. And so I brought my computer in to, and I remember the guy's name, and maybe you can help me. It was in the same shopping plaza as Caldor on the Post Road in Norwalk, Connecticut, John. And I can't remember the name of the store, but it was an Apple, authorized Apple, and the repair tech's name was John Schlegel. And I'll never forget this guy. He worked really hard. He replaced our motherboard. Apparently there was some problem with the motherboard, but he replaced that. We went home. We tried it again. No, it didn't work. So we brought it back. We brought the modem back. And I remember it was like 8:30 on a Thursday night and they were getting ready to close. And he was willing to stay late to work with us. And he said, how about this? He says, I have this other modem from, Popcom, but it was somebody will help me with the brand name, but the model name was the Popcom 1200 baud modem. And he said, this is guaranteed to work. And he plugged it in and boom, it worked. It was like, all right, that's it. Fine. We'll just take that home. So it was a full duplex 300, 1200 baud modem. And we took it home and it worked great. And as we get further down the line here, I can talk about what was going on with the 2C and some of the lessons that I learned. But that's what I got online with. And I believe the first bulletin board I ever called was called the Enterprise. And it was actually a for pay system. But I remember calling that because I knew it would be up and I knew it wouldn't be busy. And I remember logging in, and I actually still remember the randomly generated 10 character password that it gave me. And I still use that today as some secure stuff. So I won't repeat it here on the show, but
I will.
But anyway. Yeah. Good. Perfect. Yeah. If you know it, repeat it.
But anyway, so I started also. So you and I started about the same time. So I started with the Novation AppleCat 2. Which was a Bell 103 modem, which, as you may or may not know, but we're going to tell you, was a 300 baud full duplex. Now, here was the key back then, is that as the modems were evolving, they both had half duplex, which meant you could do what you could do in one direction, or you could do what you wanted to do in two directions. So the first thing, got the Novation AppleCat. I think the first bulletin board I called, Dave, was something called Treasure Vault 1, which I remember because I shortly thereafter, thanks to a friend of mine, he's out in Vegas right now and he may be coming back to Connecticut, but I shortly thereafter started a bulletin board. Now, yes, even though I only had an Apple II with 64K and a 140K floppy drive, I decided to start a bulletin board because it was just the thing to do.
Sure.
And the modem evolved with that. Some of the other systems I remember calling, and you may remember, Dave, another one, and I this one sticks in my mind, Telcom 7 was a local bulletin board, because this was the bulletin board where if you owned an Apple II, you could go online and tell all the people that had the Radio Shack color computer how terribly wrong they were in their choice of computer.
It started even back then.
Even back then. And there were the platform wars. It was the Apple II versus the color computer versus the Amiga versus whatever.
Yeah.
And we were stupid back then because we thought that, you know, our kids. Computer was the best.
Don't we still do that?
No.
Okay.
No, I mean, every computer is good at and bad at certain things. So I remember my progression was from the AppleCat 2. Now, here was the interesting thing about the AppleCat. It had both the 300 baud, which was, I think, Bell 103, but it also had, and here's where this kind of edged out the competition, it also had something called Bell 202, which was 1200 baud half duplex. And this is what got a lot of people very excited is, oh my gosh, you could go four times faster than the 300 baud people.
Right.
not only in one direction, but
for
if
a
you
file
were,
transfer, that's perfect.
If you were transferring software, then hey, you were the top of the heap. And eventually they came out with an expansion board, which I eventually got, which would let you do 1200 baud full duplex. I think that was Bell 212.
Right.
So that was one aspect of the AppleCat that I really liked. The other was that it did so many more things. And here again, I was telling people earlier, I'm going to talk about several times I got caught. Now, here was one of the other things that the AppleCat could do is that it had a very sophisticated sound generator. And it could generate not only, I think it could do four voice music, DTMF, but it could also generate those other tones that...
Multi-frequency tones, you mean?
Yes, sir. So DTMF, dual tone multi-frequency, right, is what the current system still uses, which if you don't know, when you hit buttons on your phone, it's not just one, but two, a combination of two tones. Now, the thing is, they have one for regular people, and then they have one for operators. Well, this AppleCat Moto had a program, I think it was called the Cat's Meow, which would let you generate this alternate set of tones. And, well, suffice to say, if you've read about what Wozniak and Jobs did, I decided to emulate them in that I ran what's known as a blue box, and it basically lets you be an operator and lets you do things like call other numbers or start teleconferences. And maybe, Dave, you were on one or two of them.
I'm not sure at all. This is all new to me. I'm learning along with our listeners, because I didn't have an AppleCat modem, so I couldn't I couldn't blue box. So I only read about it.
I think you may have been on one or two of the calls unknowingly, of course.
Oh, yes, of course. Well, if my phone rings, I answer it. I mean, who am I to say?
Yeah. So this this was the start of what got me into just the telecommunications thing, because back then, believe it or not, there was no internet. So if you wanted to talk to people throughout the country, and yes, I will admit, eventually the phone police did come to my house and said, "John, could you really please stop doing this?"
Right.
And by the way, here's a big list of all the calls we detected that you made, and stop it.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's interesting. I mean, there was a lot of that. You know, it wasn't like now where you could pay flat rate for long distance. Long distance rates were really expensive. Mm-hmm. And of course, if you were a kid, there wasn't really much option there. So you did have to find creative ways of getting in touch with other people. There was no internet. Mm-hmm. There was nothing else. Now, I'm going to talk about a couple of things that came into being as options. They weren't great, but as somebody in the chat saying, yeah, free long distance meant a lot in 1982, 1985, even 1989, right? I mean, it was important. Moving from that, I think that was about 1986 that I had that Popcom modem. And it was with that modem, I believe, that you and I, it was when I had that you and I met, because you had restarted your bulletin board, Treasure Vault 2, and we were using DOS 3.0. Man,
2.3,
yeah, 3.2, like 3.3 for the Apple II, not for Windows, right? But or for the PC rather. But so then I upgraded and I got I wanted to double my speed, so I went from the Popcom 1200 baud, excuse me, to a US Robotics 2400, a Courier 2400. And I remember I was home when the UPS guy came. It was very exciting. It became UPS Red Label, which I believe was next day air. We were very excited. And I plugged it in, and it didn't work. Just like the old days with that initial modem. And it was like, come on, what's going on? And I'd read enough, and I'd learned a lot since those days.
Back then, Dave, I think the problem was that they all required a magical serial cable, and that was always kind of a shot in the dark as to whether you got the wiring right.
Yeah. Well,
in a lot of cases.
That's right. And that's what it turned out to be. Now, the interesting thing was, I thought it was because the cable needed to do hardware handshaking. And of course, there's only 9 pins on the Apple IIc and 25 on the modem itself. So I got a do it yourself serial cable kit. And I was able to plug in, and it had, actually, I guess it was just a little adapter. And it was this square block that had a female RS-232 on one side and a male on the other. And mm-hmm. inside the block, you could route the cables any way you want. So I took this cable that came from my, and it was called a hardware handshaking cable that came from my, you know, mini or DIN 9 port on the 2C. And I plugged that, the RS-232 end into this block. And I meticulously started, you know, okay, here's what it should be. And I plugged it in. It was doing the same thing. The lights would like flicker and it wasn't quite right. And so then I switched pins 2 and 3, which were receive data and send data. And magically it worked. And I don't know why, but a lot of Apple IIcs were this way. And again, I'd had the motherboard replaced to supposedly fix this problem, but it didn't. So I had to, you know, I figured it out on my own. But after that, I was the serial cable master, right? I mean, I knew everything about that RS-232 cable. I could wire it any way I wanted. And eventually, that was the thing that allowed me to run a GBBS Pro bulletin board on my Apple IIc, was because I was able to wire that cable exactly the way GBBS wanted to see it. And it was in 1989 that I launched. That was the birth of RatGuck there. That's right. And I believe that's Jim, if I'm not mistaken. Let's see. Typical Maggage. Victor says, because the pinouts on the DB25 is 2 and 3, and on the 9-pin, it's 3 and 2. Yeah, well, in theory, shouldn't the cables that I buy know that? But anyway, they didn't. And so I rerouted this thing, and then magically it worked, and I had my 2400 baud. And then from that point on, I could use any cable, any modem I wanted, although that was the last modem to ever be used with my Apple IIc. And I did. I started Milliways in 1989. Mm-hmm. 203-866-2464 was the number, but please don't call that now. I'm sure someone else has it. They want to use it for their own home or whatever it is. So,
well, same with me. And then back then, Dave, so you and I had a bit of a, well, no, we overlapped our spaces. So I ran,
right.
What I must say, well, it was probably due to the fact that I was in a phone exchange back then. Of course, you know, long distance calling was somewhat expensive.
Yeah.
Versus now.
Yeah, but you were, when we talked about this in show 100, but it bears repeating here. Yeah.
Well, I was in an exchange that for some bizarre reason was local to like half of Fairfield County. It was just amazing. And I think the reason that, you know, I still had, you know, a lot of callers was just the quality of the board and the sysop, which is me. No,
of course.
So
it was.
You all too.
Of course.
Now the thing is, you and I, so of course you and I had, you know, overlapping callers and all that. And we both ran this thing called GBBS. I think Greg Schaefer was it.
Yeah, that's right. Nice.
So anyways, it was an interpreted language called GBBS, which was, I think, kind of Pascal like, or I guess it was the closest thing. And I still remember one of my crowning glories was, so one of the things this did is when you logged in, you typed in your user number. And then your password.
Right.
And I still remember this little routine. And this was, you know, when I took my baby steps to become a software developer. And what it would do is sequentially go through the user file and search every record. And I'm like, even back then, I was, you know, just starting to learn programming. And I was like, you know, this sucks. So I actually wrote a little index routine, and also, I believe, used the RAM disk. So instead of ripping through the user file, you know, and saying, OK, record one, nope, record two, nope. I wrote some very basic indexing function. I think I actually handed it off to you, Dave, to use for your board. So our boards were like renowned for, rather than you sitting there for minutes waiting for it to find your login, oh my gosh, it just kind of logged you in immediately.
Yeah.
Because I'm like, well, duh. I mean, if you have user number, whatever, why don't you just go right to that record? And through their very primitive language, figured out how to do that. But some of the other fun that we have, Dave, was a couple of the other boards that we called into. And this was just the start. It was like pre-internet. But people came up with ways where you could do multiple users per on a single board. So, of course, your board and my board, GBBS, it was pretty much you and the system operator you could chat with. That was pretty much it. But I remember a couple of words, and one guy I'm still in touch with, he lives down south. Well, there were two things. So one, he wrote something. Now, he wrote this on his PDP. So he had an employer.
He bought a PDP 9, right? Like a tag sale or something.
His employer was throwing it out.
Oh,
so it was a big
okay.
Womp and basically a mini computer at the time. And he's like, you know what? Rather than throwing that out, can I have this? And it came with BASIC and it came with a compiler and all this stuff. And he actually wrote a system, which became kind of the cornerstone of the area.
Yeah.
And he called it Comlink. And I still remember our, you know, our fun times here.
Well, you could have 4 people on at once. And of course that made the chat room great. I mean, you know, and it's funny that we're talking about this here, and I see we've got 39 people in the chat room, you know, and it's, you know, without even thinking about it. Right. And and in those days, to get four people online at once was, you know, a Herculean programming feat.
So he wrote, figured out how to program it and actually had a multi-user. I think he started with four users and I think he eventually went to, I think, eight users.
I think you're right.
Eight modems. And I still remember coming over, you know, to hang out, you know, we'd maybe have a beer or two. And I still remember, now here's the power of being a system operator, sysop, as they called it, is we would sit there, we crack a couple of beers. And now that there were our favorites and not so favorites on the chat system. And so we did a couple of things that were kind of fun, at least I thought are funny. One is if there were people on the system and anybody could call in and sign up. But if there were people that we didn't particularly like, we would accidentally, of course, toggle the power switch on the modem that they were on. But even better, and I think we crafted this in one night. I'm like, hey, Steve, can we write a routine that injects what appears to be random line noise into their data stream and maybe they'll hang up? And we did that too. And if people remember,
that's right, because he had no way of hanging. The one thing he didn't write into it was he had no way of hanging someone up. Right? There was no way. He couldn't log someone off. He could see.
There was a call to do that. There was a direct call to do that. So either we had to toggle the switch or introduce what appeared to be line noise and hope that the person would say, oh, my connection sucks, and they would hang up.
Right.
But we also had, and this was, Dave, I think it was, is it Cranberry Park?
Yeah. Yeah, Cranberry Park in Norwalk, Connecticut. Yeah.
Right. And we would have people, arrive, just randomly to meet. And I can guarantee you, Dave looked nothing. I think that was one of the first times I met you face to face, or maybe before that. But the thing is, whenever you met people that you would either chat with or talk to voice beforehand, they never, ever looked like you thought they would look like.
People say that about us now.
Yes. Well, some people think that I look like you and you look like me as far as our voices.
Right. Yeah. Okay. So moving on with the hardware, I went through a series of modems in the early 90s. I had I had the Courier 2400. Then I moved to, for a brief time, my notes are out of order. The next thing I got was a Practical Peripherals PM14-4. And John, I promised that I had some visual.
Oh, do you have it? You got it out of the box?
Dude, check this out.
Because I remember that had a display on it, I believe.
There it is. So I actually still have it. So this is my 14-4, the PM144MT2. Huh? And, it of course had this on the back. Now, by this point, by the early 90s, I had moved from the Apple IIc into Mac SE 30. But, it was all still the same. That had the mini DIN 8 and the 2C had the DIN 9. It was not the mini. But anyway, so I had that. And then for a brief time, I had a Telebit T1500, which was a V.32 9600 baud modem. That was around the time of the whole US Robotics HST 9600. There were competing 9600 baud standards. But then I moved to the, I guess I did have the Telebit first. Then I moved to the Practical Peripherals. And then I moved to the Practical Peripherals MC. One of the very first MC288 MT2 V.34, which was one of the first 288 modems.
Nice.
And it was around this time, it was just before I moved to that, there were some other ways of getting online. Now, ISP, the concept of an ISP, some, dial-up way of getting on the internet was brand new. And the first one I used was a company out in California called Portal. Now I was in Connecticut, so to dial up Portal was a very costly phone call. But there was this service called Telenet, not Telnet, but Telnet, T-E-L-E-N-E-T, which was later purchased by Sprint, and they renamed it SprintNet. And they had dial-in points of presence all over the country, and you could connect to them and then connect to services. Well, one of the services that you could buy access to was the ability to dial out through the modems that they had at their points of presence all over the country. And they had one in San Jose, which was where Portal was. So I was able to dial a local number for Telenet, and then connect out and get to Portal. Then again, right about I think it was right about 1994 was when NetAxis was the first ISP that opened up. I think they were in Stamford, Connecticut, which at that time had become local to me, where I was in Norwalk, Connecticut. So I was able to give up my Portal account. I signed up for a NetAxis account, and that was the beginning of local dial-up ISPs. And they actually supported 28.8. I think I was able to connect at 21.6. And I remember this because I found the email trail between me and their tech support guy earlier today as I was trying to peg dates and all that. But yeah, so that was very interesting. You had a NetAxis account as well, John.
NetAxis, and then I'm trying to remember. So then, Dave, I think, you know, we kind of leapfrogged each other, and I think you got this as well. But the modem that I remember, at least I see on my list. So yeah, I also got the Praktor Perfels, and one of the first ones I got from them, I think I had two. So one was similar to what you had, is that it had the LEDs.
Right.
But then I believe I got their 14.4 and had this groundbreaking LCD display.
You did have that. I remember. Oh, yeah, that was cool. I was jealous of that.
And it was, you know, it would say send, receive. It would tell you the negotiation with the remote host and all that. And it was just, you know, groundbreaking that it was like a one-line LCD display. But then I think both you and I, as time progressed, and I think the ISP we're talking about got this. So I think one of the first modems I got beyond, and I think I had a Praktor Perfels 38.4 modem.
Okay.
But then all of a sudden.
33.6, you mean?
Or 33.6, yes.
Yeah. Yeah, I never got a 33.6. And, you know, I moved to Austin in 95, and I had my 28.8 with me. I couldn't get a decent connection with my 28.8, so I figured 33.6 at that point, it just wasn't worth it. The phone lines didn't have the right mojo.
Yep. So. And here's the problem back then is that phone lines were never really meant for doing data, though they tried their best. Excuse me. But then what we got, and I think this is one of the first that I got, was a U.S. Robotics Courier X2, if I remember. And here's what that did that was groundbreaking is it did, and I believe it did, 56 or as close as it could. To 56 kilobits a second,
okay.
One way. So it was kind of this asymmetrical thing again.
Yeah.
And both you and I think, got into that. I think you got a flavor of, but I think US Robotics was one of the companies that did this, and there were others eventually. And I think that's as far as they ever got with landline throughput was 56K in one direction.
In one direction. But here's the thing. Let's talk about this, and then I want to do our next sponsor, and then I have something cool, the next piece of hardware to talk about. But yeah, the 56K was a half digital link. So it would be 56K from your ISP to you, and then it was at best 33.6 from you to them. But the way it worked was you could connect to your normal phone line. Now, your phone line had to be, you know, less than X number of feet from, you know, whatever the switch was in order for it to work. But on the other end, the ISP needed to have a digital connection to the phone circuit. And that's how they made that 56K thing work. So it really was you. The only copper involved was the copper from the switch to your house. There was no copper involved with the ISP, if I remember correctly, on the way that worked. Victor's saying in the chat that it's called switched 56, and maybe that's the term for it. But yeah, and that was cool because, again, like with your AppleCat, you know, it was the downstream that typically mattered where you were down. Even with, forget the AppleCat. Think about our cable modems today to jump to, you know, the present day. Our downstream is much faster than our upstream in most cases. So,
yep.
All right.
And I still remember back then you would tune your sometimes you may replace your analog line because things just weren't working out. I still remember when I moved into my place here. My line was cracking and all that stuff. And I eventually went to the box connected to the side of the house. And the line was literally about to fall off. In that I looked at it and I yanked on it and I actually disconnected it because it was so weathered and all that. You know, so I stripped the wire, you know, brought out some fresh copper, put it around the posts, and it was like night and day. The line was better. Though I have since, Dave, and I think you have also, but I think it was up until a couple of years ago, I still had... As a backup, which you probably are, in this case, I don't have a backup, but I used to, up until a couple of years ago, I did still have a landline. I think it was AOL. Still had a landline ISP just in case I was on the road and couldn't get connectivity through another means, but I eventually threw in the towel and said, you know, I mean, even though it was only, you know, $7 or $5 a month, it was like, sure, I don't think I need this anymore.
Sure. Yeah.
But to you, Dave.
All right. Yeah. So our second sponsor for this show is Citrix with GoToAssist, GoToAssist Express. Now, the concept here is we've all, especially those of us that are geeks or budding geeks, you know, we've got friends and family that say, hey, we want you to help us. And some of us might even, and I don't do it anymore. I don't know how much of it you're doing these days, John, but you know, some of us at various times have actually sold our services to other people where you're billing by the hour and you're out there helping. But, you know, travel time to and from can be a real bear, especially if it's a family member on the other coast or a client in Austin, and you're here in New Hampshire, for example. And this is where GoToAssist Express really comes in handy. They have built a system that works with just about every router and firewall I've checked. And it's because everything is opt-in from the user side. As the consultant, I log in and I create a session and then I send the link, for example, to you, John, right? And then you get the link and you visit this link in your browser. Meanwhile, I'm just sitting there waiting for you to do your thing. And then once you go to this link, it magically links us two together via their server and boom, we're connected. I can control your screen. You can see what I'm doing. You can turn off my session at any time. If, you know, I dig into something, you're like, oh, shouldn't be there. You know, no problem. And it works great. Now, it's GoToAssist.com. It's all available. If you go to GoToAssist.com/gab, that's G-A-B lowercase, that will give you the a 1 month free trial. So check it out at GoToAssist.com/gab. Again, this is GoToAssist Express from Citrix. Mm-hmm. All right. Now,
nice. I'm seeing some chat here, and you know, it reminds me. So you and I are spoiled, Dave, in that we live in, you know, relatively connected areas of the country here. But I'm seeing this, and actually, I've heard this. I think the last time I ran into this was when I was out in Iowa. But apparently, and I'm seeing a lot of people in the chat room say this, there are still parts of the U.S. where I guess don't take it for granted that you're going to have high speed connectivity. You may still have to use a modem. And I see at least one or two people are saying that their parents or, you know, people they know still use 28.8, which, oh, I can't even imagine that. Oh, my God. Like, we would not be doing video. At least not very very well if we were doing 28.8, sir.
Thanksgiving, and I'm going to fast forward a little bit here. Thanksgiving of 1995 was the first time I did a video, not a video, an audio chat over the internet with my family back in Connecticut. We had just moved down to Austin. And got my dad, you know, my dad had a computer in the house. And so we, you know, figured out how to set all that up. And we did an audio chat. Now, I think it was prior to Thanksgiving that the first audio chat I did was with you. You know, I think you and I had experimented with it. But I remember my dad still has it on the calendar. Thanksgiving 1995, we did an audio chat. And I can't remember what the software was. But you know, so interesting. And in I moved to Austin April 1st, 1995. And I needed to get a new internet service provider. So I tried out two of them. And the first one that I tried out was called io.com, which was Illuminati Online. And it was made by, it was run by Steve Jackson of Steve Jackson Games, the company that was raided by the feds for being peripherally, they weren't involved, but they were talking to hackers and stuff. So they were raided and had their computers taken and all this stuff. The ISP, I didn't wind up using them. It wasn't because of that. But the ISP that I wound up using was OnRamp at ONR.com because I got better connections to them. So, but that was interesting. And that was with the 28.8. At some point in there, I got the Practical Peripherals 56K modem because it was, you know, the time came. But another interesting thing happened to me in 1995. I had an opportunity to go on the road playing drums with a rock band. Now, I got the gig 3 weeks after I moved to Austin, and it was for 3 months out. I left in September. We moved in, you know, so it was more than 3 months out. But I, you know, I moved down there. The band was out of Boston. So, and I knew I was going to be on the road, and I knew I wanted to have connectivity. And we talked about this in our show 100 because I went and got a PowerBook 520C for this trip. But I also knew I needed to get a modem for it. So Let me get our Skype chat.
Was it just another band out of Boston, Dave?
Well, it was a band called Hypnotic Clambake. They're actually still touring around.
It wasn't that other Boston
band. No. So I got this, the Megahertz Cruise Card 14-4. And it's a PCMCIA card. This slid into the computer. And then on the other side, a little, I don't know if you can see it there. I'll put my hand in front of it. A little phone jack pops nice. Out. And you can plug a deal into it. So that was pretty cool. And this worked fine. But, you know, a lot of times I wasn't in a place where I could jack in. We might be in a club and there might be a payphone or whatever. Now, I had an AOL account, so there was dial-up numbers all over the country. But I believe I'm opening this for the first time since I got back from the road, because I don't think I've used it since then. But hopefully in here is... Uh-oh. Yep. Is the acoustic coupler that I used while on the road, and so you'll see that I've got there's a phone jack here, so this is what I would plug into the modem, and then you can see on the end it has these connectors that you'd strap in, and this went to one part, and you know that went to the other, and there's this big strap over the top where you'd strap it onto the handset. And then it has this little switch where you can control the level. It's got 1, 2 and X. And I mm-hmm. always remember it working fine on 1, but it was the CP Plus Telecoupler 2. I'm pretty sure we can't solicit them for a sponsorship for the show, John.
They're probably out of business.
Yeah. In fact, oh,
now,
thank
a lot
goodness,
of people in the, took the battery in the chat are pointing out now one of the movies that you and I both, remember from back then was, War Games, in which,
I just watched that with my kids recently. That was awesome.
And now the one thing that kind of struck me about that movie, Dave. So number one, of course, the beginning dialogue, they talk about things that probably would get cut now.
Yes.
That's all I'll say.
Yes.
But they had a drug infused discussion at the beginning of the film. But then, yes, I believe Matthew was using and I don't know about you, Dave. Again, I'm going to come clean here is I believe at one point I ran what they're going to call a War Games dialer.
Back definitely.
Back in my naughty youth, which was basically you would write a program and it would basically dial every number in your local exchange because you didn't want to go broke. You would basically call every number and see if it came with a carrier, and then you would explore further and see how good or not good the security was on the modem or computer system on the other end. And I think, well, that eventually, I think that they got, you know, kind of upset with people doing that because you'd be waking up everybody in your exchange because you typically run it overnight.
So. Yeah. Oh, yeah, that's right. Well, it was before caller ID, right? So nobody knew who was calling them. Yeah, because that's right. It would call, and if a computer picked up, it would save the number to a file. And if, you know, a computer didn't pick up, it would just try the next number.
Oh, and look at the, Neil here. Oh, he dialed everybody in the Blue Pages. Well, I don't know if that's smart necessarily. Well, Blue Pages is typically government.
You know, on one of those conference calls that didn't happen, John, we called the Pope.
Oh.
Yep. Got him on the
phone.
And
I still remember, I think my parents do, but okay. So this is the one thing I remember dialing. And again, I don't think I caused an international incident, but I still remember, and I think somebody handed out the number, but I still remember where I dialed in. It says, "Welcome to White Sands Missile Base." And I'm like, wow,
oh,
that's cool. Okay, let's hang up now.
Yeah, moving right along. Okay, so I think I've been through more trial. I've been on more of the bleeding edge with some of this technology at this point. Anyway, you were on the bleeding edge with the Apple Cat. It was in the late 90s that I really got hungry for more bandwidth. And, you know, I didn't have kids and, you know, money was easier to spend than it is now. But you know, I was working in the tech field. I was doing a lot of remote support and I wanted a fast connection. So... in 1998, we bought our first home. We, Lisa and I, we weren't married at the time, but we are now. We bought our first home, and I thought, man, I want a high speed connection. I want an ISDN line. So we were moving from Austin outside to a town just next to Austin called Buda. Now in Austin, Southwestern Bell was the phone carrier. In Buda, Texas is a weird
people are already.
Yeah, that's right.
So ISDN was that Integrated Services Digital Network. It was an attempt to do digital over copper.
It gave you 120, correct me if I'm wrong, because I didn't look this up, but I seem to remember it gave me 128K in both directions digitally. It was a digital connection. There was no.
That sounds right.
Yeah. Okay. So It's interesting. So I called up General Electric, which was the phone company for rural Texas. It may still be GE. Yeah. And that's right. ISDN, somebody's in the chat room talking about A and B channels. It was 64K per channel. Mm-hmm. And you could bond both channels together to get a full connection. That's right. So I called them up the day we put an offer in on the house and said, can I do an ISDN line? And they said, yes. However, we have 90 days from the day you place the order to get your ISDN line going for you. And I said, okay. They said, it's federally mandated. That's just how it's going to work. Fine. Okay. Well, let's put the order in. We were, 2 months out from closing on the house anyway. So I was like, fine, I'll live for a week, or a month.
Well, I believe back then, Dave, the nightmare was that the companies offering the connectivity and the people offering the service is that you were dealing with multiple parties who didn't necessarily have their acts together.
Yes. But this story gets really interesting. So I call them up and they get fine, and it's going to be $60 a month for the line. And then you've got to buy internet service from either GE. They would be happy to sell it to me or some third party and, whatever it is. So I said, fine. Okay. So, yes, let's do it. I call them up, a month out. We still on. Yep. We're still good. Great. I call them up a week out. Are we still on? Yep. We're still on. Okay. Mm-hmm. I call them up, the day before I call them up. We're still on. Morning of, I get a phone call and it's from the guy in the local office. And he says, we've got this order here. We're supposed to install an ISDN line for you, but, there's no way that's going to happen today. He said, we just have, we don't have the equipment here to do that, but somehow, and I have no idea how, but somehow they approved this purchase of $75,000 worth of equipment to turn on ISDN in your area. I'm thinking, well, okay, fine. And there was no contract or anything. It was a month to month deal. Right. And I'm like, great. And I said, well, how long is it going to be? He says, it's probably going to be another week or so, but you've got my direct number now. So, let's keep in touch. That's fine. Okay. I was disappointed. Obviously I was really excited to move from modem to ISDN, but hey, technology is what it is. So the next week I work my schedule. I stay in touch with the guy and he says, okay, yep, we're going to be out there. I'm bringing my team and we've got everything set up on the back end. So now we've got to get you set up. So we'll do it, Tuesday morning. So Tuesday morning, I took the day off of work or whatever. And we get there and there was the phone pole across the street was only sending one pair to our house. And we needed two pair, one for the phone line, of course, and then one for the ISDN. And they wanted to make sure it was a good quality line. So I lived on Ranch Road 967 in Buda, which was a two lane, but 70 mile an hour highway. That house was not easy to sell, mind you. But it was a great house. We had horses and everything, but, selling a house on a busy road like that. Anyway, so we had to, they had to go across the street. They had to cut this line and drop the line into the middle of the road. So we're all standing out there on the edge of the road, kind of looking for cars. Yeah. Is it cool? Can we drop it? Yes. So they cut the line and we're out there. And then the guy's up there stringing a new one. And again, we're looking for cars and we see this truck, a pickup truck coming up the road on the wrong side. And, it's like, and they're going slow. It's like, okay. We're all kind of scratching our heads and the truck comes up and I look and, out the window, the driver's got his arm out the window and he's rolling this wheel along. And I was like, what the heck is this? And I asked the guy, is this you? And they're like, no. And he was clearly measuring distance with this line. And so as the truck gets closer, I look at the side of the truck and it's his Time Warner cable on the side of it. Now, Time Warner was in Austin. We didn't have Time Warner. We had a satellite dish, right? And obviously this ISDN line. Well, as he gets closer, I stopped him and, we're all standing there. And I said, what's going on? He says, well, we're measuring, there's that new development that they're putting it out there. And we're measuring the distance and how many homes, what the home density is between here and there, because we're going to put in, cable service out in this new development. We're trying to figure out if there's enough homes here to put in, the service in between here and there. And I said, oh, and would that mean we get cable? And he said, yeah. And I said, would that mean we get cable modem, Roadrunner? And he says, yeah, you get the whole thing. We wouldn't string old stuff. You know, you're going to get the greatest. And I said, okay, now the big question, would you, it's 1995 for those of you in the chat room and those of you that have just joined us here. But yeah, so I said, you know, what do you think? He says, well, the decision isn't mine. I said, yeah, I know. What do you think? He says, oh, you'll definitely get it. And there's these guys that just spent $75,000 worth of GE's money to string this ISDN line up. And I said, how long do you think it'll be? He says, you know, probably going to be 3 or 4 weeks. And so I had that ISDN line for 2 months until I moved to the cable modem. So so it worked out fine. But in the end, for me, not so much nice. For GE. Now, with that ISDN line, something, there was a marked shift that happened. I now had a connection. Instead of having a modem on each computer, I now had a connection that was fast enough that I could share from all amongst all my computers. Now, of course, when I bought the house, my friend Daniel came over and we strung Cat 5 everywhere through the home because there was no such thing as an airport, or at least not, you know, we didn't have it then. Time for tea. But so I bought what was called, it was a 3COM device called the Office Connect LAN modem. And it does what we're all used to now, but it seemed like magic at the time. It connected to my ISDN line and it was my modem for the ISDN line. But it was also a router that does what all of our Linksys and airport routers do now. It took the one connection and shared it. And this also managed dialing up on demand because the ISDN was dialing and all of that. But it was that marked shift of, OK, now I've got house wide connectivity that we just jack into and we're good to go. So that was an interesting thing. When I moved to the cable modem, I actually did it on my Mac using Sustainable Softworks IP net router to do that connection sharing. But I did it with one Ethernet port, which is totally inadvisable. I connected, I had a hub, not even a switch, and I connected the cable modem to the switch and all my other computers to the switch. And on one of them, I got the address from the cable modem. And then on that same interface, I had a 192.168 and it worked fine. It wasn't great, but you know, it worked fine. So, you know, and then I think about a year later, I moved to a Linux box for my routing needs. So
cool.
So that's my ISDN line story.
Yep. Yeah. I totally skipped that. So, when I was,
I almost skipped it.
Yeah, you probably should have, because no, I was, so when I was in Weston, so back then we had, and I still have, so I got to say, so this one cable service, and you know, I wish everybody in the country had these guys, and they're not paying me to say this. If they'd like to, they could, but I am still with what is known as either Cablevision or Optimum Online. And these guys, except for one or two little technical gripes that I have, these guys offer some of the best, in my opinion, both cable TV service and HD and internet connectivity for a reasonable price. And when I was back in Weston, and I'm in Fairfield, but they cover both areas. And back then, now I believe it was through them. Now this is the danger of, you know, being a bit early to the game, kind of like with Dave, is that I got, and I think it was through Cablevision or maybe it was a partnership, I got an at-home cable modem.
Yeah. Now, yeah, they were all non-standard, non-DOCSIS stuff, right?
Here's the bad news, as you point out, Dave. So it was a big honking thing. Now, it didn't have, because I still remember there were some cable modems back then where they actually had external heat fins, like big old heat sinks external to the modem, because some of these things were generating quite a bit of heat because they were, you know, running at amazing speeds compared to the rest of the world. You know, even faster than ISDN, if you can imagine that.
Right.
So but the only problem was, and this was one of my first investments where I learned, you know, sometimes you just got to suck it up and sell, because it's one of the first investments I bought where they went totally under. I still remember.
Yeah.
I still remember what they did. At Home made the fatal mistake of buying Excite.
I remember that.
Because they thought, hey, you know what? People want content. It's like, no, they don't. They want fast internet.
Right.
And so they basically folded because they made this faulty decision to buy Excite and they just went down the tubes. Now, the other thing is, yeah, so it was a non-standard cable modem. And I still remember back then.
But they all were back in, to be fair. Right.
There was no DOCSIS.
There was no DOCSIS. So, yeah, my Roadrunner modem was this wacky, but it was what it was. But it, it did what, 5 megabits down and 1 up, I think, at the time. They then shortened that. But, it was good. Yeah.
But I remember constantly, and this is, where I got in the troubleshooting thing, was a lot of times the thing wouldn't work right. Now, part of it was that I lived in a house that was quite a ways away from the pole. It was about 300 feet. And that's kind of testing the limits of any device. And the thing was, sometimes I would sit there and the transmit and receive lights would just be blink, 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 blink. What's going on? This was before, as Dave pointed out, this was before you could go to 192.168.100, is it, Dave?
.100.1. And that's actually a good thing for anyone that's got a cable modem. You can do it right now in your browser window. Just don't close this chat because then you'll lose this excellent podcast that's happening. But go open up another window and go to 192.168.100.1. And that'll give you the status of your cable modem. And depending on what your provider allows, you may or may not be able to, you might get some interesting data. So,
So either the way, as someone pointed out in the chat room, the solution was, cycle power on it, which is not a solution at all.
Right.
And it would reset the transmitter and the receiver and all that stuff. Now, the thing was also is where I lived, we had about a 300-foot run from the house to the pole. Now, if you know certain parts of Connecticut, I wouldn't say it's the sticks, but every now and then you would get a critter who would take a great interest in the nutritional value of the cable. So basically, we would have cases where the squirrels, would basically munch on the cable, and that kind of impacts your signal quality. So we had a couple of times. Now, the thing is, they hated doing this, but they had to. Because I'm like, guys, the signal sucks. And I remember one time they would come out and they're like, everything's fine. And then another guy would come out and he's like, oh, no. Look, the squirrel chewed through the cable. So he would spend like a half a day running a fresh run from the house to the pole. And then everything was great again. But this was pre-standard and it was at home. And as I mentioned, yes, they went under and I lost all my shares. And it was very sad. But then, shortly thereafter, they finally, and again, I think we're talking early 90s here, they finally came up, thankfully, with a wonderful standard called DOCSIS, where in theory, you can take any cable modem that's DOCSIS compliant and put it on any DOCSIS compatible cable network. Right. So I never did the ISDN thing, Dave. There were so many. I forget some of the nasty names people use, but it was just a boondoggle. It was because, again, as I mentioned, I think you ran into this. You had one company that made the modems. You had another providing connectivity, maybe another company hooking it up. And it was just and they didn't play nice. It was just an exercise in bureaucracy and just
sure
how not to do it.
Yep. Absolutely. Absolutely. All right. Somebody's asking me if I can make this channel work with the Ustream iPhone app. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to see if I can do that. All right. There is no way to enable this for the iPhone app. We just have to do more of these. And apparently that will do it. So, for those of you that want to see the video, I will leave this video posted on Ustream. So you can download, even if you've downloaded the show, you can go to Ustream and visit the video there. So you get to see John and I and the rudimentary effects that I've done with CamTwist to make this work. Open to suggestions for those of you in the chat room for alternate views or what have you. But I can spin us around. But my guess is that's going to make someone sick. So,
whoa, what the heck's that? The spinning cube. Thanks.
The spinning cube. You like that, John? How about if we turn off the cube? Okay. So then when I moved to Connecticut, I lived on the bleeding edge. We moved to New Fairfield, Connecticut, and I knew that the home that we were moving into had the opportunity to either do DSL or cable modem. And I figured I'd pick whichever was best. Now, I actually wrote an article for Mac Addict at the time and got both and compared them and contrasted. And we had an interesting situation in that DSL was actually faster than Charter. At the time, DSL was 1 megabit down and 128K up, and Charter cable was 768 down and 64K up. So I actually lived with DSL for a while, which was interesting because it also required a login. I had the DSL modem and then I had a Linksys router. I think I had my Linux machine still was doing the PPP over Ethernet login. And then eventually Charter figured out that they were, you know, losing all their customers to DSL. So they sorted that out. And I wound up moving up to what they call the business gold package, which got me 6 megabits down and a whopping 768K up, which was actually really cool. This was back in like 2000. And it gave me a static IP, which I really, really liked. So I think it was sometime when I was in New Fairfield that I got rid of the Linux router and moved to
I still remember the at-home guy. Now, you know, never say never, but I still remember the guy when he came to install it. And I was back then fairly savvy as far as the state of the art and connections, you know, was kind of ragging on ISDN. But I knew this is that back then, both Optimum and SNET, which back then and I guess still is kind of local phone company, under other guys, they were running or both companies were advertising a fiber cable hybrid. And I believe this is still the case in most areas, including this area, is that the backbone. So what's running on the poles or at least to the routers is fiber optic. And what's running to the house is cable. Pound for pound, if you compare the two, in theory, you can get much better performance from a fiber optic line versus a piece of coax, though I would say a piece of coax is still much better than a copper line. I don't think there's any question about it. Well, it is copper. I mean, you know, a copper core typically.
Yeah, sure.
But and I still remember asking the guy, I'm like, so when do you think I'm going to get fiber to the house? And again, this was in the early 90s. And he's like, you're never going to see that. Because again, they were just starting to do what you call a fiber cable hybrid, which is running fiber on the pole and cable to the house. Now, of course, 20 years later is now you got, you know, Fios and or 30 years later, you have Fios and, you know, people running fiber optic to the house. And who knows if that's going to be the end all be all or if there's anything beyond that, Dave.
Yeah. I just posted in the chat. Somebody was mentioning they have Fios as you were going through that. And I said, I'm so jealous of the Fios people. And then it kind of hit me like, well, you know, I did. I have a DOCSIS 3 cable modem here only because I had DOCSIS 3 for like a day and a half. And it was just to check out Comcast's latest. I think it's 50 megabits down, 10 megabits up offering. And I realized it's really, really fast. I mean, especially that upstream, man, it smokes. But I don't need that. So I'm actually right now I'm on the cheapest thing that Comcast will sell me, which is 12 down and 2 megabits up. It bursts. The downstream will burst up, I think, up into the 30s, and the upstream will burst sometime around 4 or 5 for a little while. But it was cool to try that 50 megabits. It was ridiculously expensive. You know, wasn't worth it unless you're doing a lot of pushing a lot of data.
We have, that's a good question. So someone in the chat, Wandering Yankee, says, is Fios better? You know, I guess it depends because they offer tiered service, I think, just like cable. Like in our case, Dave, so we have something, and I think this has to be the fastest cable modem access because I'm pretty sure it's cable. Optimum Online has something called Optimum Online Ultra. You know, I mean, Ultra, I hope that's not the end because, I mean, maybe they'll have something better than Ultra. But Ultra, their Ultra service is 101 megabits per second downstream.
Wow.
Now you pay for it. I think you got to toss in like $50 extra a month at least to get that. But they advertise 101 megabits per second downstream with cable, as far as I know. So that's nuts. Now we also have the Boost service, which, like you mentioned, gives you a temporary boost. Yeah. And I think my service right now here with Opt Online is 15 megabits per second down to up, which is pretty standard, I think, for your basic cable service. And I'm very happy with what they offer. So.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of if Comcast. I know they said they were pushing. I saw an ad in Boston that they were doing 100 megabits or planning on doing 100 megabits. Yeah. It's good though. I mean, the faster that gets, the better off we all are. So
yeah, no, somebody here was talking about BitTorrent, which we actually have no idea what they're talking about. But
I use BitTorrent all the time to download live shows from bands like Fish and actually, you know, I found on BitTorrent on the eTree.org, I think I found two of the shows I played with Hypnotic Clambake back in 1995. If you find any Hypnotic Clambake shows between, say, September 1st and November 10th of 1995, I played drums on those. I think there was one from Erie, Pennsylvania, and one, the one from that crazy show in Buffalo, New York at Nietzsche's. That was nice. So anyway, nice. So now here's
here's the mini fish shake about that whole thing, Dave, and I think some people can. So you may have heard this recent ruling. The FCC was told they're not allowed to. I got to have a mini fish shake against just the media.
Shake your fist. They can see. Wait, hang on. We gotta.
There we go.
No. Do that again. There he is.
There we go.
In all his glory. Now.
Shaking the fist. But anyways, there was a recent ruling. Now, one, you get some of your political nutcases totally misrepresenting this. But the problem is that he recently ruled that the FCC is not permitted, and that this is where we get the political hysteria, to control the internet. No, it's not controlling the internet. There's a thing called net neutrality, which, and you and I, Dave, talked about this, and I think the basic fact of the matter right now is that in most areas, you pretty much have a monopoly. Like here, it's Opt Online. Where you are, it's Comcast. Where our parents live, it's Comcast. You don't have a choice, at least as far as a single medium. I have not seen this in Connecticut, as far as I know. If you want cable modem and you're in my part of the Connecticut, it's Opt Online. If you're somewhere else, it's Comcast or maybe Charter or somebody. But you don't have a choice. And the problem is, I guess, you know, some people have been saying, wouldn't it be nice to have net neutrality, which my definition of that is, you get the connection and nobody gets to shape or modify or block or do whatever. And this is a whole debate between free market and regulation and stuff like that. Now, unfortunately, again, the problem is some people are misrepresenting this as, it's the FCC controlling the internet. And it's like, no, it's not that at all.
I don't see it that way. Yeah.
To me, if anything, it's making a controlled monopoly accountable for what they do. That's my view, and that's I'll get off the political soapbox. But to me, I see it as a good thing.
Yeah, I agree with you.
You shouldn't if it was a total free market solution, and that I had multiple people to choose from to get my internet service or my cable modem service, and one wants to shape their traffic and one doesn't, then I'm totally in agreement that the free market is the way to solve this.
But correct.
It, the way it is set up, at least in my part of the country, and I think your part of the country, Dave, and most of us, you don't have a choice.
Yeah.
So I don't see it as control.
I'm with you on that. You know me. I'm like a whack job libertarian living here in New Hampshire.
I use that
label, but it's really an incorrect label for me, but it's about as close as it gets. I just believe in, you know, let me do my thing. And that's it. Let me do my thing. And if you're only going to let one company string wires here, well, then, you know, you got to make them let me do my thing. So there you go.
Victor, Dave told me this is how I should talk into the mic.
Victor, I've been doing this with Victor Cahill from the Typical Mac User podcast. Fantastic podcast. And also the Typical Shutterbug podcast, to give him a big shout out. Is noticing that in the video stream, John and I are both using Heil PR40 mics, and they are end fire mics, meaning the element is at the end of the microphone.
I should talk like this,
right? So we should, you know, it's not in the side of the mic; it's at the end of the cylinder. And what I've found over the years of using this mic is that talking across the mic, so essentially having the mic aimed at the side of my face and then kind of sitting back a bit, works a lot better. It allows me to get a much clearer signal, and I don't get this, you know, way too close to the mic thing going on. I get this, and I can talk and pop and you don't get those pops like you get, for example, when I'm traveling or using that other one. And so when John and I started doing video, I noticed, he's talking directly into the end, and that's why I'm getting some of those pops out of him. So I thought it was, you know, I thought it was Skype. I thought it was this. So now we fixed it. And it has the added benefit of lots of added benefits. One, I can move my hands all around and it doesn't hit this mic stand that's not in front of me. And two, you can see our faces when we're talking.
Well, I don't know if that's necessarily a benefit, Dave.
Well, hey, they're the ones watching, man. All right. Do we have anything else? I could talk about the satellite connection just to throw it in there. Yes. If you're in an area of the country that is not wired for high speed, you can do it wirelessly with satellite in most areas of the world, or at least most areas of the country, I believe. But you know, so that's another option. The latency on that is pretty bad. You know, it's usually about a 3/4 to 1 second ping time turning around, which is really slow. But things like Skype work over it. So, you know,
the upstream. And then, yeah. And then, of course, unless you own your home, I think a lot of condo and other associations don't necessarily like you slapping a dead, though they've gotten much smaller. I mean, as you and I have seen through our geekdom, Dave, I mean, dishes used to be, you know, huge.
Yeah.
Now they're, you know, a couple of feet across, and you can clamp them on your railing or something. And Jeff, hopefully you have a...
Jeff Quistad, who of course works with us over at Backbeat Media and has been a huge part of what we do there for many years. And maybe he's even watching, but he just moved in. He lives in Austin. He just moved from one place in Austin to another. And he tried out a service called Clear. It's at clear.com. Mm-hmm. I'll put a link in the chat room. And it's WiMAX is what it is. It's a Wi-Fi signal, but it's, you know, wide area Wi-Fi. It worked okay for him as long as he held his foot just right, put the modem like in a corner of the window, and didn't have any other devices near it, which was really funny. They told him, do you have anything else near it? He says, well, like a router. And they said, yeah. He said, yeah. When they said, well, that might cause a problem. He says, well, I'm supposed to have a router near it. That's how it works. So, So it's an interesting thing. I'm going to jump back to the microphone thing because I see in the chat that Todd was asking about microphones. And Victor, you said that Todd should get a PR20 for $150. Well, they have the PR20 utility microphone now for $99. It doesn't come with the fancy case. It doesn't come with the multiple heads. It's the normal PR20 mic with the normal head. And these things are awesome. Way better than a Shure SM58 in my book. And for $99, they're way more than worth the price. So, so anyway, actually I use them. I've held them in my hand before, but anyway, we're getting off topic and I'm letting the chat drive things, which is cool. You know, I know we're getting late here, John, but we have a question that that I've saved for a while, and it's time for us to answer this question because I believe we have the answer for Simon's question. So let me make sure this is going to work.
Hello, John and Dave. Simon here from Farnborough in the UK. I'm actually calling on behalf of a couple of friends of mine. They both run Macs. And for the last, certainly the last couple of years at least, I think, they've been sending me a message, an audio message every week, very, very reliably.
Interesting.
And it's always very good, very entertaining. However, just recently they've been getting some problems with audio, where it's kind of hiccuping and stuttering, things like that. It's a bit weird. I think they use Audio Hijack Pro, something like that. I'm not quite sure. So anyway, just wonder if you know what might be going on and could shed any light on it. It'd be really, really interesting. Anyway, keep up the good work with the podcast. It's great stuff. And here's where you cut me off.
All right. Thanks, Simon. And of course, Simon is this is a little bit tongue in cheek because Simon is, of course, referring to us and all of those hiccup problems that we were having. For those of you that subscribe to the premium show, you know that we have found the answer. For those of you that don't, you may have heard that we found the answer in so much as that those hiccups are gone. So Simon, I can help you. We have done some research here and you can tell your friends this, FireWire audio on the Mac sucks. It's unreliable. And you have, you can have all kinds of problems.
You gotta qualify that, Dave. It only sucks on the Intel machines.
Yeah, that's right. It sucks. Well, it sucks with later versions of Leopard and Intel or both.
Okay.
Yeah.
I mean, to be fair.
Yeah, that's no, you're right.
Suck consistently across.
It's consistent. Yes. Yeah. So what I did was, you know, we've got this beautiful Mackie Onyx 1220 board that we've been using for years with the FireWire interface. But as you've all heard, it had all those cracking and popping and issues and such. So recently, Andy Dolph recommended to me that, you know, when I said I'm looking for a USB interface, he recommended the Tascam US1641 for $300. It's got 16 inputs and 4 outputs, and it works great. We haven't had any problems with it. The audio still sounds fine. I mean, it's, you know, it's still a, if we want it to be a 96K 24-bit interface, and it's been great. So, yep. So we love it, and I don't have to think about it anymore. We're still using the Mackie board to mix the show live so that I can bring levels down and up, but otherwise, you know, the interfacing is going through the, I've just got analog cables going back and forth from the Mackie board to the Tascam. So,
and I see someone in the chat room making a wise observation. Well, the reason we won't, To tell you here, I mean, some of you may know, so I'm on a G5 dual 2 gigahertz.
Right.
And actually, I'm right now, I think Skype is actually working as it should here, because I'm pretty much at about 90% on both of my my processors here. And I think that reflects in the quality of the picture you're seeing. But also, I am using, let's see, it's the Hue HD webcam, Dave.
Yeah.
Which, oddly enough, apparently their reports are Apple broke something in Snow Leopard so that their camera does not reliably work. I think it's a QuickTime issue or something like that. But this is a 1.3 megapixel webcam. It's actually very nice. It has a base. It has a flexible arm. And actually, I have it right now where it's actually sitting and blocking part of my view of my monitor. But, you know, for you guys, I'll, you know. And it has a, it's not autofocus, but it's a nice HD, in my opinion, nice HD unit here. And the thing is, it works fine on Leopard, because right now on the G5, of course, I have no option to be on Snow Leopard.
Oh, well, there is an option,
but it's not a very, good one.
Right, right.
I think I told you I recently updated the mom off of Tiger and her iBook G4, and she's now on Snow Leopard on a nice refurb. So I'm running that camera, but fortunately the drivers work just fine on Leopard, though, you know, looking here at the processor utilization, it may eventually be time to
especially if you keep doing these video shows. I know I'm thinking about I might have to get a an 8-core machine here to manage all this video. Let's talk briefly about the setup that we're doing here. I talked about this a little bit in the pre-show, but we're using a piece of software called CamTwist. Of course, John and I are connected via Skype. Now, John's sending me his video via Skype. I'm not sending him mine, because on the Mac, the camera can only be attached by one program at a time. So John's sending me his video. I'm pumping my video directly into this software called CamTwist. And then I'm capturing, and this is weird, I'm capturing John's video so that I can blend them together. And those of you in the room are seeing that I can do a little picture in picture with John or me, or a side by side, or, you know, various other things. But the way I'm capturing John's video is sort of old school, and it's the only way to do it, is I'm doing a screen grab of a specific spot on the screen. So if I move my mouse into John's call window, oh no, it doesn't do anything. Oh, because I have Skype set to be on top. But if I move John's Skype window around, his video moves all over the place. So but it works, and it lets me do this. And CamTwist then creates essentially a virtual camera that I can then plug into Ustream, which is what you all are seeing on the web. And it seems to work, doing all of this, plus having Audio Hijack running and routing all of our audio and recording all of our audio. My CPUs are at 71%, 40% of that Skype, 40% of it is the Ustream broadcaster plug-in flash thing, and another 25% CamTwist. And yeah, so it's, you know, it's not bad. 14% Audio Hijack Pro. So,
nice. You know what baffles me, Dave, though?
What's that?
I mean, I hear from multiple people. Now, I got off of the whole, Mac is better for everything bandwagon a long time ago.
Yeah.
Especially, and I'll still say for development, I still, dig Windows for some development work here. But I was shocked at the difficulty that you had in trying to get, my impression was, this is a Mac. There are audio professionals that use the Mac. How can, and not doubting your abilities, of course, Dave, but I'm like, how can people use the Mac to do audio work? And there's this blatantly obvious bug in the FireWire driver. And I'm still baffled as to why this is the case. Unless they just threw them out the window and they got or their analog. I don't know. But it just baffled me that this is such an issue. It's crazy. It was just terrible.
Yeah, it's crazy. So anyway, I do want to try Boinks TV as well and see which one I like better as far as, you know, rerouting the audio. But it seems Ustream's working. My guess is we will do more of these. But for now, I think it's time to bid everyone adieu. We're at I don't even know where we are. We're probably at close to an hour and a half on this one. So
10:30.
It's time.
I think so.
All right. So we'll fade the band in. And let's see, contact information. You can call us at 206-666-GEEK,
which is 4335. You can email us, Dave. Did you know you could email us, Dave, at feedback@macgeekab.com?
Did you just say feedback@macgeekab.com?
No, I think what I said is feedback@macgeekab.com, Dave. And I'm sticking great. To that.
That's awesome. You can email us text, of course, but you can also send us audio comments. You can do it straight from your iPhone using the Voice Memo app. It works great, and we love to hear from you. Mm-hmm. You can Skype us to MacGeekGab, and you can leave us iTunes comments. That's that. Michael Johnston from the This Week in iPhone podcast converts this show to AAC for you. I don't think Michael was in our chat room tonight. I was hoping to see him, but I don't think he was. Cashfly.com provides all the bandwidth for getting this show from us to you. The podcast marketplace has some fantastic sponsors. We really appreciate the support that they have given and continue to give us. You know, this is one of those special shows. It's show 256. They're all special shows, but, you know, I'd just like to thank everybody, not only our sponsors, but, of course, all of you, our listeners. We wouldn't and couldn't do this without you. So thank you very much.
Well, it could, but it'd be very boring.
Yeah, it wouldn't be at all the same, and it wouldn't be nearly as much fun. And I don't think we
you guys make the community what it is here.
Yeah,
and the Mac community.
Yeah, it really is.
I think. So,
the podcast marketplace this month includes Audio Engine with their A2 desktop speakers, Barebone Software with Yojimbo and BB Edit, PDF Pen, Disk Label, and Text Expander from Smile on My Mac, Notebook from Circus Ponies, and GoToAssist Express at GoToAssist.com/Gab, all through the Backbeat Media Podcast Network. Another great group of guys. That's it. Let's get out of here. Still got to convert this thing.
No. Did you hit the record button?
No!
Oh, I think that happened once. And only once.
That sucked.
Another fish shake.
All right, have fun. We're doing more podcasts this week, so be good and don't get caught.
Made up.